Well, it is a great privilege to be with you this day, March 19th, 2024, of the Common Era. The time is 1358 hours Eastern Daylight Time. Ward Green with you again for the study of the Crucible article. And this first quote I want to take from the article Joseph and Own. And there are no paragraph numbers here. Nor chapter, well, there are chapter numbers, I think, are there? Or maybe, no, there aren't. There are no chapter numbers either, that's right. It's just a long, continuous stream. Now, Joseph, this is the quote. Joseph was appointed a, quote, father to Pharaoh, unquote, or end quote. That's from Genesis 45 and 8. And they used to call out, I might add, that they called out Avrek in front of Joseph when he was riding in Pharaoh's second chariot as the second in command of all Egypt. And by calling out Avrek, that meant father to Pharaoh. Av being father and Rek being the king or the Pharaoh. Father to Pharaoh, they called out in front of Joseph. Joseph is identifiable with Osiris, Poseidon, and Pan, it says in this paragraph also, in the Joseph and Own article. Pan being the shepherd god. Pan is associated with Capricorn, and yours truly is born under this sign, and the constellation Capricorn was in the past the location of the winter solstice. That's a much bigger story about the solstice, but there we go. Oh my goodness. And then you can read further in the article. It's about two-thirds of the way down here in the article where the quote comes from, near the picture of the Cnidian Aphrodite, or Cnidian Aphrodite. That illustration, it's near that if you're looking for it. You can just do a text search using Command F or whatever your Windows key is. Control F, maybe it is in Windows, I think. By the way, yeah, I mentioned the other day that the I think I said that Isaac and Jacob were twins, but of course it was Esau and Jacob who were twins. And I also mentioned that Joseph came into Egypt in 1914. It was Jacob who came into Egypt in 1914. Joseph was already there ever since 1936, when Joseph was 17 years old and was sold into Egypt, born late in 1954 BCE. And then in 1923, Joseph officially began to live in Egypt when he was no longer a prisoner or a slave, but at that time he was released from prison, became a citizen in that year, 1923. And that's why the 430 years begins in 1923 and ends at the Exodus in 1493 BCE. In conclusion now, from chapter 8, paragraph 12 of the Crucible of Credible Creed, the patriarch Joseph ruled in all of Egypt. He spent much of his life in Egypt and became well known. This much God's word tells us from the highest authority. The Crucible crows co-rule by crown chronology as follows. It is fascinating that the chronology of his life shows an aging Joseph at the time of Pharaoh Amenemhet III, Moiris, and renders time for his co-rule with Pharaoh Amenemhet II. Pharaoh Amenemhet II of the 12th dynasty appointed him the second in command of all Egypt, and Joseph ruled Egypt for many years, little children, continuing to perform great works into his old age. As we've seen in this article, but we will see it in the other articles too when we study those. At least it's in some of those other articles, certainly the earlier ones particularly, and with Amenemhat II is the son of Senusret I. Here's the thing. Joseph becomes Senusret II, holding a name of the father of Amenemhat II. It's another reason why he was called father to Pharaoh. Perhaps that's the main reason why he was called father to Pharaoh. The mythological character Poseidon fits well with Joseph. And we saw also Osiris, Pan. Joseph is identified with so many different figures in Greek mythology. It's astonishing, really. I don't think we have time today, but myths in the mist of prehistory make identities uncertain, because myths are from prehistory or from the time when there was no chronology, in other words. Yet the chronology indicates that, at least nowadays, we have a chronology, and it's indicating that Joseph lives as Senusret II, Senusret III, and Amenemhat III are pharaohs of Egypt. The Bible says that the true God appointed Joseph a father to Pharaoh, and that Joseph dominated, quote, over all, end quote, of Egypt. Over all of Egypt. That's how powerful Joseph was. And the whole anti-Semitic world would just be thrilled to be able to deny that. Joseph also ruled over the household of Pharaoh. Oh, I thought of something the other day. Do you know why the Greek statues are always portrayed scantily clad and with their robes hanging off of them and falling off? It suddenly occurred to me the other day that the story of Joseph, where the chief, the man he was working for, the wife of the man, was trying to seduce Joseph, and she was pulling him onto her divan or her bed, and in order to get away, he left his robe, his garment, in her hands, and he ran away naked. So that is fascinating, and it's a very fascinating explanation to my mind. It suddenly came to me, that's why these Greek gods are portrayed so often with robes that are just barely covering their bodies, and they're portrayed naked and all of this. It fits the story of Joseph in particular, who left his garment in the hands of the woman who was trying to seduce him, who was the wife of his boss at that time. Joseph also ruled over the house of Pharaoh. He also ruled over the household of Pharaoh and had a bride from the priestly city of On, which is also called in the Greek Heliopolis. And this bride was a daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On. She was named Asenath. Pharaohs were commonly associated with the city called On. In addition to the remarks in the article On, which is Joseph and On, we just quoted from at the beginning, it's also called for short On, because there's the article Joseph and there's the article Joseph and On. So we can just call them Joseph and then the article On as two separate articles. But we're talking about the second one, Joseph and On. There were papyri at Kahun, called El Lahun, also, the worker's village that is associated with the building of the pyramid of Senusret II. This is important. That's his pyramids in the Fayum region. Fascinating that it's in that region, because that's where Joseph's canal is, of course, showing that the descendants of Jacob, or Israel, as he was also known, lived there, because there are papyri there in the worker's village. These papyri are what show that descendants of Israel lived in this worker's village in El Lahun in the Fayum region. That's where it is. I'm trying, I better I'm not even sure if it, maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe it's in the area of Giza. I'm trying to think. Where's Cahoon? I'm not sure now. I think I'm imagining it's in the Fayum region, but I could be wrong about that. My memory might be playing a trick on me there, but I mean, anybody who thinks that they are without any, you know, errors or is obviously deluding themselves. I know I make mistakes, but the thing is, I don't have any need to respond to somebody who doesn't believe the work that I do. You know, that's the thing. Showing that the descendants of Jacob or Israel lived here. Where's Cahoon? I have to look it up. Where's Cahoon? We've got to find out where it is. Cahoon, Egypt. Here it is. Okay. El Lahoon. Yeah, there it is. I found it, but where is it? It's Al-Fayum, in the Al-Fayum governance, so it's in the Fayum region. Is that remarkable or what? It's amazing. This is I've got the Google map here. I'm just trying to zoom out now and see. Yeah, it's right near the Fayum. Yeah, it's near Lake Moeris. Okay. Just needed to verify that so that I don't become too uncertain in my thoughts, but that's what it is. There's actually proof that in that region, that's where his pyramid is located. It's unbelievable. Senushet II, whom we also identified as Joseph, it's incredible. It's unbelievably good as proof, right? If we're trying to have any the best case scenario, this would be it. This is the best case scenario that we could have as far as where this pyramid is located, as far as the evidence that Senushet II was Joseph himself. Markings on pottery here, that is at El Lahoon, and evidence at nearby Gurob show that the first alphabet, written sounds, that is, you see, alphabet is written sounds. There's another name for alphabet. I forgot what that is. What's the name for alphabet? Hebrew alphabet. It's an abjad. Yeah, it's an abjad, like the Arabic alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet. They're called abjads. They're alphabets. In other words, the sounds are written. Like the letter K is a K sound. You know, so, and B is the B, letter B. It's the writing of sounds, whereas symbols that represent you know, objects, like you could depict an animal as a drawing, a symbol that could depict the animal. It's not the sound, it's the animal or the object itself. It could be a symbol for a house or a symbol for a table or what. All these different objects could have symbols, but that's not an alphabet. But this is the first alphabet that was created there in El Lahoon. Noted British archaeologist Sir Flinders Petrie concluded, here's what he said, it will require a very certain proof of the supposed Arabian source of the Phoenician alphabet before we can venture to deny that we have here, that is, at Cahoon, Egypt, the origin of the Mediterranean alphabets. In other words, the alphabet was invented or developed first or exhibited first by the Hebrews, in Egypt. Israel had the alphabet, the Amu, as the Egyptians referred to Israel. According to Samuel Kurinsky, brought a great many advances to Egypt in addition to irrigation and language, examples being the socketed heads for inserting handles into axes or sledges. These were the inventions brought by Israel into Egypt. The socketed heads for inserting handles into axes or sledges, bronze metal weaponry, and wheels for wagons and chariots. In other words, they invented the wheel. Now, compelling, the Rhind Mathematical Papyrus is a copy of a lost text associated with Pharaoh Amenemhat III. Now, how coincidental is that? Because that was a text that we said was written in the time of Moses, might even have been written on that piece of papyrus was over. It was originally a mathematical papyrus, but it was written over top of. You know, they wrote over their old, they reused their old papyri, and that was one that was reused. But I mean, how would it have been? How would it have been reused in the time of Moses? I mean, it's incredible. If it was written by Moses himself, we have here a reason how it could get into his hands, because it was actually associated with Amenemhet III, who was one of the Israelites, as we've shown and identified him by identifying him as Manasseh. That we've seen that he was one of the he wasn't the ancestor of Moses directly, because he was of the tribe of Joseph, but obviously he's one of the Israelites. And so this rhymed mathematical papyrus, that Moses would have understood that it was from the time of Amenemhet III is possible, and that Moses would have also understood that it was from Manasseh is also possible. It's an absolutely mind-boggling revelation and correspondence, again, between these things that we've been saying. True worship is circumstantial evidence, right? That's what it is, circumstantial evidence. True worship, musical instruments we call lyres. These are other things the Israelites brought to Egypt. Elections for establishing new leadership. The list goes on and on. The sheer number of the innovations brought by the Amu, or Easterners, into Egypt is staggering, being very great. We have seen how the timing has affected details about the life of the patriarch Joseph. Fitting to Egyptian history, whether his greatest works were as architect or as father, does a father of Amenemhet III remain father to Pharaoh? Were you there when Joseph was called Pharaoh Senusret II? The end of chapter 8. But this is incredible, because it's, I mean, when I say incredible, I mean it's more credible than it should be. It's what I'm saying. It's certainly far more impressive than it ever should have been. That's why we believe it easily can be seen to be true, because he's the father of Pharaoh. He was called the father of Pharaoh, Joseph was, partly because we have seen it's true that Senusret II had the name of the father of Amenemhet II, who was also called Senusret. He was the first pharaoh called Senusret. He was followed by Amenemhet II. And then they tended to alternate, so the father of Senusret I was Amenemhet I, and every grandson would have the same name as his grandfather. But after Amenemhet II came, fittingly, Senusret II, same name as the father of the pharaoh, so father to pharaoh. Joseph was father to pharaoh, as Senusret II had the same name as Senusret I. So if Joseph was Senusret II, if that's true, then he had the same name as the father of the pharaoh under whom he was serving when he was second in command of all Egypt. So he was the father to Pharaoh by having the name of the pharaoh's father. But also, later, he was the father of Senusret III, who came after Senusret II, and the Egyptians would never have done that. That's not likely that they would have a son with the same name as the father. But the Joseph's lineage, pharaonic line, could do that, because they didn't follow the traditions of the Egyptians, so they could have the son having the same name as the father. So Senusret II followed by Senusret III could easily be seen to be Joseph and his son, Ephraim. And then his son, Amenemhet III, he was also the father of that pharaoh. So he's the father of Pharaoh. by being the father of Amenemhat III, as well as by being the father, not the father of Amenemhat II, but he was by name the same name as the father of Amenemhat II as well. So it's so true that he was father to Pharaoh, and that we can say is very good circumstantial evidence that Joseph was in fact Senusret II, the Pharaoh of Egypt, a father to Pharaoh. That's all for chapter 8 in the Crucible article, and that's all for today in that. In 2 Kings 6 and 20, but before we do that, I forgot to prepare this just a minute here. There it is, yeah. There's nothing really to prepare here. We did it yesterday, 14:6. We're going to do 14:7. Take leave of a fool. Is that what we're going to do? Or are we going to do something else? I think we should just continue on. Take leave of a fool. This is our proverb for today, little children. Take leave of a fool. Go from him. Yes, depart. For you in his word will find no learned art. The wisdom of wise ones. Oh, that's the next part. But that's it for Proverbs 14 and 7. Take leave of a fool. Go from him. Yes, depart. For you in his word will find no learned art. There's a time to leave and go away from a conversation, you see. 2 Kings 6 and 20. Look at this. It came about that as soon as they arrived at Samaria, Elisha then said, O Jehovah, open the eyes of these that they may see. Immediately Jehovah opened their eyes and they got to see, and here they were in the middle of Samaria. They had no idea they were in the middle of Samaria until he opened their eyes. So it's exceedingly easy to see how Jesus could have blinded the eyes of his disciples so that they didn't recognize him, even though he had materialized the same exact likeness of his own body that he had had previously. So it's not a problem at all to understand that. Now we want to look at our reading from Second Chronicles. You know what? I meant to read yesterday. Didn't get around to it. The Queen of Sheba, in the Insight book, it mentions that Solomon was visited by the Queen of Sheba, of course. Now, in the articles also, in several articles, we have a mention, well, I can't remember the names of the articles right now, it's easy to find, if you just search for the name Menelik, or the Queen of Sheba, and you search online on the site with the site search site:willofjehovah.com and then space and then Menelik or Queen of Sheba, and you'll find the references to Menelik, who was the son of Solomon by means of the Queen of Sheba. So she came to him when she went back. Evidently she was pregnant and she had a son. He ruled Ethiopia, and the date of his rule proves, because there were only 16 years average rule, also proves that Solomon did not rule any later than the date that we give, because that would make the number of years per king even lower. If we lowered the date of Solomon, there tend to be something more like about 22 years per rulership for kings who are not always, if the descent line is not continued, so that if the son is not always the next king, whereas if the son is always the next king, it's typically it's 27 or 28 years per king or per rule. But it's if it's typically, you know, 22 years is typical, but for the case where sometimes the son is not the next king, but it's the brother or some other new person who becomes king. But anyway, when we study Menelik, we see more evidence regarding the time of Solomon, the dating of King Solomon. And we see that when she brings 120 talents of gold to Solomon, it's valued at $46 million. Sometime in the 1980s, this was written. So, it's a lot of money, isn't it? $46 million, but it's still not as much as one might have thought. And Rehoboam proceeded to go to Shechem, 2 Chronicles chapter 10. For it was to Shechem that all the Israelites came to make him king. This is after Solomon died, after ruling 40 years. His son was Rehoboam. And verse 2, and it came about that as soon as Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard of it while he was yet in Egypt, because he had run away on account of Solomon the king, Solomon was going to kill Jeroboam. So Jeroboam ran away. Jeroboam immediately came back from Egypt when he heard that Solomon was dead. So they sent and called him, and Jeroboam and all Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, your father, for his part, made our yoke hard. Now make the hard service. Okay, so Jeroboam came to Rehoboam, the new king of Judah, and he said to him, or he was the king of all Israel, actually. And then he said, look, give us a break. That's what he said, okay? What have I got? I don't know if... there. He said, give us a break. And what Rehoboam did after he consulted with various people, he said, I'm not going to give you a break. In fact, I'm going to make it harder for you. And so that's what caused Jeroboam to then say, well, I'm going to go start my own kingdom. And he went to the north and started the northern kingdom and split off 10 of the tribes of the 12, split off from Israel, became the northern kingdom of Israel. And the southern kingdom was called Judah after that. So that's what happened here. And the Israelites, in verse 19, kept up their revolt against the house of David down to this day. Rehoboam was son of Solomon, the grandson of David. Rehoboam was the grandson of David, so he was of the house of David. But the northern kingdom revolted against them and split off from that kingdom of Judah, which included also the tribe of Benjamin. Obadiah, the vision of Obadiah. Now this is apparently, according to Adam Clark, he says, nobody really has a positive, certain clue about when this book was written, but it was evidently the only thing that people have come up with is probably it was written around the time of the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, so in our chronology, that's BCE 587. The well established and documented destruction. It's a year exact. It's an exact year, 587. That was when the destruction of Jerusalem occurred. The vision of Obadiah. This is what, now, if this is when he wrote, sometime around that destruction, but after he wrote after the destruction. This, it says here. Right. Oh, a little before he flourished, it says here, by Clark says, a little before or a little after the taking of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. Okay. Now, this is what the Sovereign Lord Jehovah has said regarding Edom. Obadiah writes, there is a report that we have heard from Jehovah, and there is an envoy that has been sent among the nations. Rise up, you people, and let us rise up against her in battle. Look, small is what I have made you among the nations. You are despised very much. This is what Jehovah said against Edom. The presumptuousness of your heart is what has deceived you. The presumptuousness of your heart is what has deceived you, you who are residing in the retreats of the crag, the height where he dwells, saying in his heart, who will bring me down to the earth? Yeah, it's like arrogance, right? Who's going to bring me down? Right? Einstein said, the only thing more dangerous than ignorance is arrogance. A fascinating thing, right? Arrogance. It's not that you don't know something, but that you refuse to know. That's the difference, right? Who will bring me down to the earth? In other words, unrepentant too. Unrepentant people who don't listen when they're corrected. Who will bring me down to the earth? These arrogant ones say. You should make your position high like the eagle, Jehovah says. Or if among the stars there were a placing of your nest, down from there I would bring you, is the utterance of Yahweh. If it were thieves that came into you, if despoilers came in by night, to what extent would you have been silenced? Would they not steal as much as they wanted? Or if it were grape gatherers that came into you, would they not let some gleanings remain? Oh, the extent to which those of Esau have been searched out, how his concealed treasures have been sought out. As far as the boundary they have sent you, the very men in covenant with you have all deceived you. The men at peace with you have prevailed against you. Those eating food with you will place a net under you, as one in whom there is no discernment. Will it not be in that day, is the utterance of Jehovah? And I shall certainly destroy the wise ones out of Edom and discernment out of the mountainous region of Esau. Edom is the same as Esau. Remember, Esau came out of the womb all red, like a garment of hair. And your mighty men must become terrified, O Teman, for the reason that each one will be cut off from the mountainous region of Esau because of a killing, because of the violence to your brother Jacob. Shame will cover you. Esau was trying to kill Jacob because Jacob had bought or tricked Esau into selling him his birthright. And you will have to be cut off to time indefinite. In the day when you stood off on the side, in the day when strangers took his military force into captivity. That's when Nebuchadnezzar took Jerusalem into captivity. And when outright foreign occurred, of course, the captivity occurred in the year 597 BCE. That's an exact year also. And when outright foreigners entered his gate and over Jerusalem they cast lots, you also were like one of them. And you ought not to watch the sight in the day of your brother, in the day of his misfortune. And you ought not to rejoice at the sons of Judah in the day of their perishing. And you ought not to maintain a big mouth in the day of their distress. That's perfect. Perfect way to conclude. It goes on, but it's a one chapter book. So this is the end of Obadiah. This one chapter is all there is of the book of Obadiah. We could perhaps read the last verse. And saviors will certainly come up onto Mount Zion in order to judge the mountainous region of Esau. So it's still talking about the same thing. And the kingship must become Yahweh's. It belongs to the true God, in other words, the kingship. It doesn't belong to some humans or anything like that. So that's it for today's study. It's March, the end of our video, March 19th, 2024 of the Common Era, the time. It's 14:31 Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. And I love you very much. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie, and they're saying bye for now.